the Corps knows the details of the physical, human, and AI future to a margin of 98.995% for a period of at least 2 centuries. The AI Advisory Council to the All Thing, with its vague Delphic utterances, considered so indispensable by humans, is a joke. The Corps drops tidbits of revelations to the hegemony when it serves the Corps' purposes, sometimes to aid the volatiles, sometimes the stables, but always to please the ultimates. Hyperion is a rent in the entire predictive fabric of the Corps' existence. It is the penultimate oxymoron, a non-factorable variable. Impossible as it seems, Hyperion appears to be exempt from the laws of physics, history, human psychology, and AI prediction as practiced by the Corps. The result has been two futures, two realities, if you will. One in which the Shrike Scourge, soon to be released on the web and interstellar humanity, is a weapon from the Corps-dominated future, a retroactive first strike from the volatiles who rule the galaxy millennia hence. The other reality sees the Shrike invasion, the coming interstellar war, and the other products of the Time Tomb's opening as a human fist struck back through time, a final twilight effort by the ousters, ex-colonials, and other small bands of humans who escaped the volatiles' extinction programs. Water dripped on tile. Somewhere in the tunnels nearby, a mech cauterizer's warning siren echoed from ceramic and stone. I leaned against the wall and stared at Johnny. "Interstellar war," I said. "Both scenarios demand an interstellar war?" "Yes, there is no escaping that." "Can both core groups be wrong in their prediction?" "No. What happens on Hyperion is problematic, but the disruption in the web and elsewhere is quite clear. The Ultimates use this knowledge as the prime argument for hurrying the next step in core evolution." "And what did BB's stolen data show about us, Johnny?" Johnny smiled, touched my hand, but did not hold it. "It showed that I am somehow part of the Hyperion unknown. Their creation of a Keet cybrid was a terrible gamble. Only my apparent lack of success as a Keet's analog allowed the stables to preserve me. When I made up my mind to go to Hyperion, the volatiles killed me with the clear intention of obliterating my AI existence if my cybrid again made that decision." "You did. What happened?" "They failed. In the Corps' limitless arrogance, they failed to take two things into account. First, that I might invest all consciousness in my cybrid and thus change the nature of the Keet's analog. Second, that I would go to you."
"Me?"
He took my hand. "Yes, Ron. It seems that you also are part of the Hyperion unknown." I shook my head. Realizing that there was a numbness in my scalp above and behind my left ear, I raised my hand, half expecting to find damage from the datum plane fight. Instead, my fingers encountered the plastic of a neural shunt socket. I jerked my other hand from Johnny's grasp and stared at him in horror. He'd had me wired while I was unconscious. Johnny held up both hands, palms toward me. "I had to, Braun. It may be necessary for the survival of both of us." I made a fist. "You fucking low-life son of a bitch! Why do I need to interface directly, you lying bastard?" "Not with the Corps," Johnny said softly. "With me." "You?" My arm and fist quivered with the anticipation of smashing his vat-cloned face. "You?" I sneered. "You're human now, remember?"
"Yes, but certain cybrid functions remain. Do you remember when I touched your hand several days ago and brought us to Datum Plain?" I stared at him. I'm not going to Datum Plain again. No, nor am I, but I may need to relay incredible amounts of data to you within a very short period of time. I brought you to a black market surgeon in the dregs last night. She implanted a Schrone disc. Why? The Schrone loop was tiny, no larger than my thumbnail, and very expensive. It held countless field bubble memories, each capable of holding near infinite bits of information. Schrone loops could not be accessed by the biological carrier, and thus were used for courier purposes. A man or woman could carry AI personalities or entire planetary data spheres in a Schrone loop. Hell, a dog could carry all that. Why? I said again, wondering if Johnny or some forces behind Johnny were using me as such a courier. Why? Johnny moved closer and put his hand around my fist. Trust me, Braun. I don't think I'd trusted anyone since Dad blew his brains out 20 years ago and Mom retreated into the pure selfishness of her seclusion. There was no reason in the universe to trust Johnny now. But I did. I relaxed my fist and took his hand. All right, said Johnny. Finish your meal and we'll get busy trying to save our lives. Weapons and drugs were the two easiest things to buy in Dreg's Hive. We spent the last of Johnny's considerable stash of black marks to buy weapons. By 2200 hours, we each wore whiskered Titan Poly body armor. Johnny had a Gunda's mirror black helmet, and I wore a Force Surplus command mask. Johnny's power gauntlets were massive and a bright red. I wore osmosis gloves with killing trim. Johnny carried an ouster hell whip captured on Brescia and had tucked a laser wand in his belt. Along with Dad's automatic, I now carried a Steiner Gin minigun on a gyrode waist brace. It was slaved to my command visor, and I could keep both hands free while firing. Johnny and I looked at each other and began giggling. When the laughter stopped, there was a long silence. Are you sure the Shrike Temple here on Lussus is our best chance? I asked for the third or fourth time. We can't forecast, said Johnny. All the Corps has to do is record a malfunction and we're dead. We can't even take an elevator from the lower levels. We'll have to find unmonitored stairways and climb the 120 floors. The best chance to make the temple is straight down the concourse mall. Yes, but will the Shrike Church people take us in? Johnny shrugged, a strangely insectoid gesture in his combat outfit. The voice through the Gunda helmet was metallic. They're the only group which has a vested interest in our survival, and the only ones with enough political pull to shield us from the hegemony while finding transit for us to Hyperion. I pushed up my visor. Mayna Gladstone said that no future pilgrimage flights to Hyperion would be allowed. The Dome of Mirror Black nodded judiciously. Well, fuck Mayna Gladstone, said my poet lover. I took a breath and walked to the opening of our niche, our cave, our last sanctuary. Johnny came up behind me. Body armor rubbed against body armor. Ready, Braun? I nodded, brought the minigun around on its pivot, and started to leave. Johnny stopped me with a touch. I love you, Braun. I nodded, still tough. I forgot that my visor was up, and he could see my tears. The Hive is awake all 28 hours of the day, but through some tradition, third shift was the quietest, the least populated. We would have had a better chance at the height of first shift rush hour along the pedestrian causeways. But if the Gundas and Thuggies were waiting for us, the death toll of civilians would have been staggering. It took us more than 3 hours to climb our way to Concourse Mall, not up a single staircase, but along an endless series of met corridors, abandoned access verticals swept clean by the Luddite riots 80 years ago, and a final stairway that was more rust than metal. We exited onto a delivery corridor less than half a click from the Shrike Temple.
"I can't believe it was so easy," I whispered to him on intercom.
"They are probably concentrating people on the spaceport and private Farcaster clusters." We took the least exposed walkway onto the concourse, 30 meters below the first shopping level and 400 meters below the roof. The Shrike Temple was an ornate, freestanding structure, now less than half a click away. A few off-hour shoppers and joggers glanced at us and then moved quickly away. I had no doubt that the mall police were being paged, but I'd be surprised if they showed up too quickly. A gang of brightly painted street thugs exploded from a lift shaft, hollering and whooping. They carried pulse knives, chains, and power gauntlets. Startled, Johnny wheeled toward them with the Hell Whip sending out a score of targeting beams. The minigun whirred out of my hands, shifting from aiming point to aiming point as I moved my eyes. The gang of seven kids skidded to a halt, held up their hands, and backed away, eyes wide. They dropped into the lift shaft and were gone. I looked at Johnny. Black Mirrors looked back. Neither of us laughed. We crossed to the northbound shopping lane. The few pedestrians scurried for open shop fronts. We were less than 100 meters from the temple stairs. I could actually hear my heartbeat in the Force helmet earphones. We were within 50 meters of the stairs. As if called, an acolyte, or priest of some sort, appeared at the 10-meter door of the temple and watched us approach. 30 meters. If anyone was going to intercept us, they would have done it before this. I turned toward Johnny to say something funny. At least 20 beams and half that many projectiles hit us at once. The outer layer of the Titan Poly exploded outward, deflecting most of the projectile energy in the counterblast. The mirrored surface beneath bounced most of the killing light. Most of it. Johnny was flung off his feet by the impact. I went to one knee and let the minigun train on the laser source. 10 stories up along the residential hive wall, my visor opaqued. Body armor burned off in a steam of reflective gas. The minigun sounded precisely like the kind of chainsaw they use in history holodramas. 10 stories up, a 5-meter section of balcony and wall disintegrated in a cloud of explosive flechettes and armor-piercing rounds. 3 heavy slugs struck me from behind. I landed on my palms, silenced the minigun, and swiveled. There were at least 12 of them on each level, moving quickly in precise combat choreography. Johnny had reached his knees and was firing the Hell Whip in orchestrated bursts of light, working his way through the rainbow to beat bounce defenses. One of the running figures exploded into flame as the shop window behind it turned to molten glass and spattered 15 meters onto the concourse. 2 more men came up over the level railings, and I sent them back with a burst from the minigun. An open skimmer came down from the rafters, repellers laboring as it banked around pylons. Rocket fire slammed into concrete around Johnny and me. Shop fronts vomited 1 billion shards of glass over us. I looked, blinked twice, targeted, and fired. The skimmer lurched sideways, struck an escalator with 12 cowering civilians on it, and tumbled in a mass of twisting metal and exploding ordnance. I saw one shopper leap in flames to the high floor 80 meters below. "Left!" shouted Johnny over the tight beam intercom. 4 men in combat armor had dropped from an upper level using personal lift packs. The polymerized chameleon armor labored to keep up with the shifting background, but only succeeded in turning each man into a brilliant kaleidoscope of reflections. 1 moved inside the sweep arc of my minigun to neutralize me, while the other 3 went for Johnny. He came in with a pulse blade, ghetto style. I let it chew at my armor, knowing it would get through to forearm flesh, but using it to buy the second I needed. I got it. I killed the man with the rigid edge of my gauntlet and swept the minigun fire into the 3 worrying Johnny. Their armor went rigid, and I used the gun to sweep them backward like someone hosing down a littered sidewalk. Only one of the men got to his feet before I blew them all off the level overhang. Johnny was down again. Parts of his chest armor were gone, melted away. I smelled cooking flesh, but saw no mortal wounds. I half-crouched, lifted him.
"Leave me, Braun. Run, the stairs."
The tight beam was breaking up.
"Fuck off,"
I said, getting my left arm around him enough to support him while allowing room for the minigun to track.
"I'm still getting paid to be your bodyguard."
They were sniping at us from both walls of the hive, the rafters, and the shopping levels above us. I counted at least 20 bodies on the walkways. About half were brightly clad civilians. The power assist on the left leg of my armor was grinding. Straight-legged, I awkwardly pulled us another 10 meters toward the temple stairs. There were several Shrike priests at the head of the stairs now, seemingly oblivious to the gunfire all around them.
"Above!"
I swiveled, targeted, and fired in one moment, hearing the gun go empty after one burst, and seeing the second skimmer get off its missiles in the instant before it became 1,000 pieces of hurtling, unrelated metal and torn flesh. I dropped Johnny heavily to the pavement and fell on him, trying to cover his exposed flesh with my body. The missiles detonated simultaneously, several in airburst and at least 2 burrowing. Johnny and I were lifted into the air and hurled 15 or 20 meters down the pitching walkway. Good thing. The alloy and ferro-concrete pedestrian strip, where we had been a second before, burned, bubbled, sagged, and tumbled down onto the flaming walkway below. There was a natural moat there now, a gap between most of the other ground troops and us. I rose, slapped away the useless minigun and mount, pulled off useless shards of my own armor, and lifted Johnny in both arms. His helmet had been blown off, and his face was very bad. Blood seeped through a score of gaps in his armor. His right arm and left foot had been blown off. I turned and began carrying him up the Shrike Temple stairs. There were sirens and security skimmers filling the concourse flyspace now. The Gundas on the upper levels and far side of the tumbled walkway ran for cover. 2 of the commandos who had dropped on lift packs ran up the stairs after me. I did not turn. I had to lift my straight and useless left leg for every step. I knew that I had been seriously burned on my back and side, and there were shrapnel wounds elsewhere. The skimmers whooped and circled, but avoided the temple steps. Gunfire rattled up and down the mall. I could hear metal-shod footsteps coming rapidly behind me. I managed another 3 steps. 20 steps above, impossibly far away, the bishop stood amid 100 temple priests. I made another step and looked down at Johnny. One eye was open, staring up at me. The other was closed with blood and swollen tissue.
"It's all right,"
I whispered, aware for the first time that my own helmet was gone.
"It's all right. We're almost there."
I managed one more step. The 2 men in bright black combat armor blocked my way. Both had lifted visors streaked with deflection scars, and their faces were very hard.
"Put him down, bitch, and maybe we'll let you live."
I nodded tiredly, too tired to take another step or do anything but stand there and hold him in both arms. Johnny's blood dripped on white stone.
"I said, put the son of a bitch down and..."
I shot both of them, 1 in the left eye and 1 in the right, never lifting Dad's automatic from where I held it under Johnny's body. They fell away. I managed another step, and then another. I rested a bit, and then lifted my foot for another. At the top of the stairs, the group of black and red robes parted. The doorway was very tall and very dark. I did not look back, but I could hear from the noise behind us that the crowd on the concourse was very large. The bishop walked by my side as I went through the doors and into the dimness. I laid Johnny on the cool floor. Robes rustled around us. I pulled my own armor off where I could, then batted at Johnny's. It was fused to his flesh in several places. I touched his burned cheek with my good hand. "I'm sorry." Johnny's head stirred slightly and his eye opened. He lifted his bare left hand to touch my cheek, my hair, the back of my head. "Fanny." I felt him die then. I also felt the surge as his hand found the neural shunt, the white light warmth of the surge to the Schroen loop, as everything Johnny Keats ever was or would be exploded into me. Almost, almost, it was like his orgasm inside me 2 nights earlier. The surge and throb and sudden warmth and stillness after, with the echo of sensation there. I lowered him to the floor and let the acolytes remove the body, taking it out to show the crowd and the authorities and the ones who waited to know. I let them take me away. I spent 2 weeks in a Shrike Temple recovery crash. Burns healed, scars removed, alien metal extracted, skin grafted, flesh regrown, nerves rewoven. And still I hurt. Everyone except the Shrike priests lost interest in me. The Corps made sure that Johnny was dead, that his presence in the Corps had left no trace, that his cybrid was dead. The authorities took my statement, revoked my license, and covered things up as best they could. The web press reported that a battle between dregs-level hive gangs had erupted onto the concourse mall. Numerous gang members and innocent bystanders were killed. The police contained it. A week before word came that the hegemony would allow the Yggdrasil to sail with pilgrims for the war zone near Hyperion, I used a temple farcaster to cast a Renaissance vector where I spent an hour alone in the archives there. The papers were in vacuum press, so I could not touch them. The handwriting was Johnny's. I had seen his writing before. The parchment was yellow and brittle with age. There were 2 fragments. The first read, "The day is gone, and all its sweets are gone. Sweet voice, sweet lips, soft hand, and softer breast. Warm breath, light whisper, tender semitone. Bright eyes, accomplished shape, and languorous waist. Faded the flower and all its budded charms. Faded the sight of beauty from my eyes. Faded the shape of beauty from my arms. Faded the voice, warmth, whiteness, paradise. Vanished unseasonably at shut of eve, when the dusk holiday, or holy night, a fragrant curtained love begins to weave the woof of darkness thick for hid delight. But as I've read love's missal through today, he'll let me sleep, seeing I fast and pray." The second fragment was in a wilder hand and on rougher paper, as if slashed across a notepad in haste. "This living hand, now warm and capable of earnest grasping, would, if it were cold and in the icy silence of the tomb, so haunt thy days and chill thy dreaming nights, that thou wouldst wish thine own heart dry of blood, so in my veins red life might stream again, and thou be conscious calmed. See, here it is. I hold it towards you. I'm pregnant." I think that Johnny knew it. I don't know for sure. I'm pregnant twice. Once with Johnny's child, and once with the Schroen loop memory of what he was. I don't know if the two are meant to be linked. It will be months before the child is born, and only days before I face the Shrike. But I remember those minutes after Johnny's torn body was taken out to the crowd, and before I was led away for help. They were all there in the darkness, hundreds of the priests and acolytes and exorcists and ostiaries and worshippers. And as one voice, they began to chant, there in that red dimness under the revolving sculpture of the shrike, and their voices echoed in Gothic vaults. And what they chanted went something like this. Blessed be she. Blessed be the mother of our salvation. Blessed be the instrument of our atonement. Blessed be the bride of our creation. Blessed be she. I was injured and in shock. I didn't understand it then. I don't understand it now. But I know that when the time arrives and the shrike comes, Johnny and I will face it together.
It was long after dark. The tram car rode between stars and ice. The group sat in silence, the only sound the creak of cable. After a time had passed, Lenore Hoyt said to Braun Lamia, "You also carry the cruciform." Lamia looked at the priest. Colonel Cassad leaned toward the woman.
"Do you think Hetmestein was the Templar who had spoken to Johnny?"
"Possibly. I never found out."
Cassad did not blink.
"Were you the one who killed Mestine?"
"No."
Martin Silenus stretched and yawned.
"We have a few hours before sunrise. Anyone else interested in getting some sleep?"
Several heads nodded.
"I'll stay up to keep watch,"
said Fedmon Cassad.
"I'm not tired."
"I'll keep you company," said the consul.
"I'll heat some coffee for the therm."
When the others slept, the infant Rachel making soft cooing sounds in her sleep, the other three sat at the windows and watched the stars burn cold and distant in the high night. 6. Kronos Keep jutted from the easternmost rim of the great Bridal Range. A grim, baroque heap of sweating stones, with 300 rooms and halls. A maze of lightless corridors leading to deep halls, towers, turrets, balconies overlooking the northern moors, air shafts rising half a kilometer to light and rumored to drop to the world's labyrinth itself. Parapets scoured by cold winds from the peaks above, stairways inside and out, carved from the mountain stone and leading nowhere, stained glass windows 100 meters tall, set to catch the first rays of solstice sun or the moon on midwinter night, paneless windows the size of a man's fist, looking out on nothing in particular, an endless array of bas-relief, grotesque sculptures in half-hidden niches, and more than 1,000 gargoyles staring down from eave and parapet, transept and sepulchre, peering down through wood rafters in the great halls and positioned so as to peer in the blood-tinted windows of the northeast face, their winged and hunchbacked shadows moving like grim sundial hours, cast by sunlight in the day and gas-fed torches at night. And everywhere in Kronos Keep, signs of the Shrike Church's long occupation, atonement altars draped in red velvet, hanging and freestanding sculptures of the Avatar with polychrome steel for blades and blood gems for eyes, more statues of the Shrike carved from the stone of narrow stairways and dark halls so that nowhere in the night would one be free of the fear of touching hands emerging from rock, the sharp curve of blade descending from stone, four arms enveloping in a final embrace. As if in a last measure of ornamentation, a filigree of blood in many of the once occupied halls and rooms, arabesques of red spattered in almost recognizable patterns along walls and tunnel ceilings, bedclothes caked hard with rust-red substance, and a central dining hall filled with the stench of food rotting from a meal abandoned weeks earlier, the floor and table, chairs and wall adorned with blood, stained clothing, and shredded robes lying in mute heaps. And everywhere, the sound of flies.
"Jolly fucking place, isn't it?"
said Martin Silenus, his voice echoing. Father Hoyt took several steps deeper into the great hall. Afternoon light from the west-facing skylight 40 meters above fell in dusty columns. "It's incredible," he whispered. "St. Peter's in the New Vatican is nothing like this." Martin Silenus laughed. Thick light outlined his cheekbones and satyr's brows.
"This was built for a living deity," he said.
Fedmon Kassad lowered his travel bag to the floor and cleared his throat.
"Surely this place predates the Shrike Church."
"It does," said the consul. "But they've occupied it for the past 2 centuries.
"It doesn't look too occupied now,"
said Braun Lamia. She held her father's automatic in her left hand. They had all shouted during their first 20 minutes in the keep, but the dying echoes, silences, and buzz of flies in the dining hall had reduced them to silence.
"Sad King Billy's androids and Bond clones built the goddamn thing,"
said the poet.
8 local years of labor before the spin ships arrived. It was supposed to be the greatest tourist resort in the web, a jumping-off point for the Time Tombs and the City of Poets. But I suspect that even then the poor schmuck android laborers knew the locals' version of the Shrike story.
Saul Weintraub stood near an eastern window, holding his daughter up so that the soft light fell across her cheek and curled fist.
"All that matters little now. Let's find a corner free of carnage where we can sleep and eat our evening meal."
"Are we going on tonight?"
"To the tombs?"
asked Silenus, showing real surprise for the first time on the voyage.
"You'd go to the Shrike in the dark?"
Lamia shrugged.
"What difference does it make?"
The consul stood near a leaded glass door leading to a stone balcony and closed his eyes. His body still lurched and balanced to the movement of the tramcar. The night and day of travel above the peaks had blurred together in his mind, lost in the fatigue of almost 3 days without sleep and his rising tension. He opened his eyes before he dozed off, standing up.
"We're tired. We'll stay here tonight and go down in the morning."
Father Hoyt had gone out onto the narrow ledge of balcony. He leaned on a railing of jagged stone. "Can we see the tombs from here?"
"No,"
said Silenus.
"They're beyond that rise of hills. But see those white things to the north and west a bit? Those things gleaming like shards of broken teeth in the sand?"
"Yes."
"That's the City of Poets. King Billy's original site for Keats and for all things bright and beautiful. The locals say that it's haunted now by headless ghosts."
"Are you one of them?"
asked Lamia. Martin Silenus turned to say something, looked a moment at the pistol still in her hand, shook his head, and turned away. Footsteps echoed from an unseen curve of staircase, and Colonel Kassad re-entered the room.
"There are 2 small storerooms above the dining hall. They have a section of balcony outside, but no other access than this stairway. Easy to defend. The rooms are clean."
Silenus laughed.
"Does that mean nothing can get at us, or that when something does get at us, we'll have no way to get out?"
"Where would we go?"
asked Saul Weintraub.
"Where indeed?"
said the consul. He was very tired. He lifted his gear and took one handle of the heavy Mobius cube, waiting for Father Hoyt to lift the other end.
"Let's do what Kassad says. Find a space to spend the night. Let's at least get out of this room. It stinks of death."
Dinner was the last of their dried rations, some wine from Silenus's last bottle, and some stale cake which Saul Weintraub had brought along to celebrate their last evening together. Rachel was too little to eat the cake, but she took her milk and went to sleep on her stomach, on a mat near her father. Lenar Hoyt removed a small balalaika from his pack and strummed a few chords.
I didn't know you played.
Poorly. The consul rubbed his eyes.
I wish we had a piano.
You do have one.
The consul looked at the poet.
Bring it here. I'd welcome a scotch.
What are you talking about? Snapped Father Hoyt. Makes sense.
His ship. Do you remember our dear, departed, voice of the bush, Mastine, telling our consul friend that his secret weapon was that nice hegemony single ship sitting back at Keats Spaceport? Call it up, your consulship. Bring it on in.
Kassad moved away from the stairway where he had been placing trip beams.
The planet's datasphere is dead. The commsats are down. The orbiting force ships are on tight beam. How is he supposed to call it?
It was Lamia who spoke.
A fatline transmitter.
The consul moved his stare to her.
Fatline transmitters are the size of buildings.
Braun Lamia shrugged.
What Mastine said made sense. If I were the consul, if I were one of the few thousand individuals in the entire damn web to own a single ship, I'd be damn sure I could fly it in on remote if I needed it. The planet's too primitive to depend on its comnet, the ionosphere's too weak for shortwave, the commsats are the first things to go in a skirmish. I'd call it by fatline.
And the size?
Braun Lamia returned the diplomat's level gaze.
The hegemony can't yet build portable fatline transmitters. There are rumors that the ousters can.
The consul smiled. From somewhere there came a scrape and then the sound of metal crashing.
Stay here,
said Kassad. He removed a death wand from his tunic, canceled the trip beams with his tactical comm log, and descended from sight.
I guess we're under martial law now,
said Silenus when the colonel was gone.
Mars Ascendant.
Shut up.
Do you think it's the Shrike? The consul made a gesture.
The Shrike doesn't have to clank around downstairs. It can simply appear here.
Hoyt shook his head. I mean the Shrike that has been the cause of everyone's absence. The signs of slaughter here in the keep.
The empty villages might be the result of the evacuation order,
said the consul.
No one wants to stay behind to face the ousters. The SDF forces have been running wild. Much of the carnage could be their doing.
With no bodies?
Laughed Martin Silenus.
Wishful thinking. Our absent hosts downstairs dangle now on the Shrike's steel tree, where, ere long, we too will be.
Shut up,
Braun Lamia said tiredly.
And if I don't?
Grinned the poet.
Will you shoot me, madam?
Yes.
The silence lasted until Colonel Kassad returned. He reactivated the trip beams and turned to the group seated on packing crates and flow foam cubes.
It was nothing. Some carrion birds, harbingers, I think the locals call them, had come in through the broken glass doors in the dining hall and were finishing the feast.
Silenus chuckled.
Harbingers. Very appropriate.
Kassad sighed, sat on a blanket with his back to a crate, and poked at his cold food. A single lantern brought from the wind wagon lighted the room, and the shadows were beginning to mount the walls in the corners, away from the door to the balcony.
It's our last night. One more story to tell.
He looked at the consul. The consul had been twisting his slip of paper with the number 7 scrawled on it. He licked his lips.
What's the purpose? The purpose of the pilgrimage has been destroyed already.
The others stirred. What do you mean? Asked Father Hoyt. The consul crumpled the paper and threw it into a corner.
For the Shrike to grant a request, the band of pilgrims must constitute a prime number. We had 7. Mastine's disappearance reduces us to 6. We go to our deaths now, with no hope of a wish being granted.
Superstition,
said Lamia. The consul sighed and rubbed his brow.
Yes, but that is our final hope.
Father Hoyt gestured toward the sleeping infant. Can't Rachel be our seventh? Saul Weintraub rubbed his beard.
No. A pilgrim must come to the tombs of his or her own free will.
But she did once, said Hoyt. Maybe it qualifies.
No,
said the consul. Martin Silenus had been writing notes on a pad, but now he stood and paced the length of the room.
Jesus Christ, people! Look at us! We're not six fucking pilgrims, we're a mob! Hoyt, there, with his cruciform, carrying the ghost of Paul Duray. Our semi-sentient Erg in the box there. Colonel Cassad, with his memory of Moneta. M. Braun, there, if we're to believe her tale, carrying not only an unborn child, but a dead romantic poet. Our scholar, with the child his daughter used to be. Me, with my muse. The consul, with whatever fucking baggage he's brought to this insane trek. My God, people, we should have received a fucking group rate for this trip.
Sit down,
said Lamia, in a dead, even tone. No, he's right, said Hoyt. Even the presence of Father Duray in cruciform must affect the prime number superstition somehow. I say that we press on in the morning in the belief that—
Look!
Cried Braun Lamia, pointing to the balcony doorway where the fading twilight had been replaced with pulses of strong light. The group went out into the cool evening air, shielding their eyes from the staggering display of silent explosions which filled the sky. Pure white fusion bursts expanding like explosive ripples across a lapis pond. Smaller, brighter plasma implosions in blue and yellow and brightest red, curling inward like flowers folding for the night. The lightning dance of gigantic hell-whip displays, beams the size of small worlds cutting their swath across light hours and being contorted by the riptides of defensive singularities. The aurora shimmer of defense fields leaping and dying under the assault of terrible energies, only to be reborn nanoseconds later. Amid it all, the blue-white fusion tails of torch ships and larger warships slicing perfectly true lines across the sky like diamond scratches on blue glass.
The ousters,
breathed Braun Lamia.
The war's begun,
said Cassad. There was no elation in his voice, no emotion of any kind. The consul was shocked to discover that he was weeping silently. He turned his face from the group.
"Are we in danger here?"
asked Martin Silenus. He sheltered under the stone archway of the door, squinting at the brilliant display.
"Not at this distance,"
said Cassad. He raised his combat binoculars, made an adjustment, and consulted his tactical comm log.
"Most of the engagements are at least 3 AU away. The ousters are testing the force space defenses."
He lowered the glasses.
It's just begun.
Has the Farcaster been activated yet? Are the people being evacuated from Keats and the other cities?
Cassad shook his head.
I don't believe so. Not yet. The fleet will be fighting a holding action until the cislunar sphere is completed. Then the evacuation portals will be opened to the web while force units come through by the hundreds.
He raised the binoculars again.
It'll be a hell of a show.
Look! It was Father Hoyt pointing this time, not at the fireworks display in the sky, but out across the low dunes of the northern moors. Several kilometers toward the unseen tombs, a single figure was just visible as a speck of a form, throwing multiple shadows under the fractured sky. Cassad trained his glasses on the figure.
The Shrike?
No, I don't think so. I think it's... a Templar by the looks of the robe.
Hetmastine, cried Father Hoyt. Cassad shrugged and handed the glasses around. The consul walked back to the group and leaned on the balcony. There was no sound but the whisper of wind, but that made the violence of explosions above them more ominous somehow. The consul took his turn looking when the glasses came to him. The figure was tall and robed, its back to the keep, and strode across the flashing vermilion sands with purposeful intent.
"Is he headed toward us or the tombs?"
asked Lamia.
"The tombs."
Father Hoyt leaned elbows on the ledge and raised his gaunt face to the exploding sky. "If it is Mastine, then we're back to Seven, aren't we?"
"He'll arrive hours before us. Half a day if we sleep here tonight as we proposed."
Hoyt shrugged. "That can't matter too much. Seven set out on the pilgrimage, Seven will arrive, the Shrike will be satisfied."
"If it is Mastine,"
said Colonel Cassad.
"Why the charade on the wind wagon? And how did he get here before us? There were no other tram cars running, and he couldn't have walked over the bridle range passes."
"We'll ask him when we arrive at the tombs tomorrow," Father Hoyt said tiredly. Braun Lamia had been trying to raise someone on her comlog's general comm frequencies. Nothing emerged but the hiss of static and the occasional growl of distant EMPs. She looked at Colonel Cassad.
"When do they start bombing?"
"I don't know. It depends upon the strength of the Force Fleet defenses."
"The defenses weren't very good the other day when the ouster scouts got through and destroyed the Yggdrasil."
Cassad nodded.
"Hey,"
said Martin Silenus.
"Are we sitting on a fucking target?"
"Of course. If the ousters are attacking Hyperion to prevent the opening of the Time Tombs, as M. Lamia's tale suggests, then the tombs and this entire area would be a primary target."
"For nukes?"
asked Silenus, his voice strained.
"Almost certainly,"
answered Cassad. "I thought something about the antientropic fields kept ships away from here," said Father Hoyt.
"Crude ships," said the consul,
without looking back at the others from where he leaned on the railing.
"The antientropic fields won't bother guided missiles, smart bombs, or hellwhip beams. It won't bother mech infantry, for that matter. The ousters could land a few attack skimmers or automated tanks and watch on remote while they destroy the valley."
"But they won't. They want to control Hyperion, not destroy it."
"I wouldn't wager my life on that supposition,"
said Cassad. Lamia smiled at him.
"But we are, aren't we, Colonel?"
Above them, a single spark separated itself from the continuous patchwork of explosions, grew into a bright orange ember, and streaked across the sky. The group on the terrace could see the flames, hear the tortured shriek of atmospheric penetration. The fireball disappeared beyond the mountains, behind the keep. Almost a minute later, the consul realized that he had been holding his breath, his hands rigid on the stone railing. He let out air in a gasp. The others seemed to be taking a breath at the same moment. There had been no explosion, no shockwave rumbling through the rock. "A dud?" asked Father Hoyt.
"Probably an injured Force skirmisher trying to reach the orbital perimeter, or the spaceport at Keats,"
said Colonel Cassad.
"He didn't make it, did he?"
asked Lamia. Cassad did not respond. Martin Silenus lifted the field glasses and searched the darkening moors for the Templar.
"Out of sight. The good captain either rounded that hill just this side of the Time Tombs Valley, or he pulled his disappearing act again."
"It's a pity that we'll never hear his story," said Father Hoyt. He turned toward the consul. "But we'll hear yours, won't we?" The consul rubbed his palms against his pant legs. His heart was racing.
"Yes,"
he said, realizing even as he spoke that he had finally made up his mind.
"I'll tell mine."
The wind roared down the east slopes of the mountains and whistled along the escarpment of Kronos Keep. The explosions above them seemed to have diminished ever so slightly, but the coming of darkness made each one look even more violent than the last.
"Let's go inside,"
said Lamia, her words almost lost in the wind sound.
It's getting cold.
They had turned off the single lamp, and the interior of the room was lighted only by the heat lightning pulses of color from the sky outside. Shadows sprang into being, vanished, and appeared again as the room was painted in many colors. Sometimes the darkness would last several seconds before the next barrage. The consul reached into his traveling bag and took out a strange device, larger than a comm log, oddly ornamented, and fronted with a liquid crystal disc key, like something out of a history hollow.
Secret Fatline transmitter?
Braun Lamia asked dryly. The consul's smile showed no humor.
It's an ancient comm log. It came out during the Hegira.
He removed a standard micro-disc from a pouch on his belt and inserted it.
Like Father Hoyt, I have someone else's tale to tell before you can understand my own.
Christ on a stick!
Sneered Martin Silenus.
Am I the only one who can tell a straightforward story in this fucking herd? How long do I have to...
The consul's movement surprised even himself. He rose, spun, caught the smaller man by the cape and shirt front, slammed him against the wall, draped him over a packing crate with a knee in Silenus's belly and a forearm against his throat, and hissed.
One more word from you, poet, and I'll kill you.
Silenus began to struggle, but a tightening on his windpipe and a glance at the consul's eyes made him cease. His face was very white. Colonel Cassad silently, almost gently, separated the two.
There will be no more comments.
He touched the death wand in his belt. Martin Silenus went to the far side of the circle, still rubbing his throat, and slumped against a crate without a word. The consul strode to the door, took several deep breaths, and walked back to the group. He spoke to everyone but the poet.
I'm sorry. It is just that I never expected to share this.
The light from outside surged red and then white, followed by a blue glow which faded to near darkness.
We know,
Braun Lamia said softly.
We all felt that way.
The consul touched his lower lip, nodded, roughly cleared his throat, and came to sit by the ancient comm log.
The recording is not as old as the instrument. It was made about 50 standard years ago. I'll have some more to say when it's over.
He paused as if there were more to be said, shook his head, and thumbed the antique disc key. There were no visuals. The voice was that of a young man. In the background, one could hear a breeze blowing through grass or soft branches, and more distantly, the roll of surf. Outside, the light pulsed madly as the tempo of the distant space battle quickened. The consul tensed as he waited for the crash and concussion. There was none. He closed his eyes and listened with the others.
The Consul's Tale. Remembering Ciri. I climbed the steep hill to Ciri's tomb on the day the islands returned to the shallow seas of the equatorial archipelago. The day is perfect, and I hate it for being so. The sky is as tranquil as tales of old Earth's seas. The shallows are dappled with ultramarine tints, and a warm breeze blows in from the sea to ripple the russet willow grass on the hillside near me. Better low clouds and gray gloom on such a day. Better mist or a shrouding fog which sets the masts in First Sight Harbor dripping and raises the lighthouse horn from its slumbers. Better one of the great sea simoons blowing up out of the cold belly of the south, lashing before it the motal isles and their dolphin herders until they seek refuge in the lee of our atolls and stony peaks. Anything would be better than this warm spring day, when the sun moves through a vault of sky so blue that it makes me want to run, to jump in great loping arcs and to roll in the soft grass, as Ciri and I have done at just this spot. Just this spot. I pause to look around. The willow grass bends and ripples like the fur of some great beast as the salt-tinged breeze gusts up out of the south. I shield my eyes and search the horizon, but nothing moves there. Out beyond the lava reef, the sea begins to chop and lift itself in nervous strokes. Ciri, I whisper. I say her name without meaning to do so. 100 meters down the slope, the crowd pauses to watch me and to catch its collective breath. The procession of mourners and celebrants stretches for more than a kilometer to where the white buildings of the city begin. I can make out the gray and balding head of my younger son in the vanguard. He's wearing the blue and gold robes of the hegemony. I know that I should wait for him, walk with him, but he and the other aging council members cannot keep up with my young, ship-trained muscles and steady stride. But decorum dictates that I should walk with him and my granddaughter Lyra and my 9-year-old grandson. To hell with it, and to hell with them. I turn and jog up the steep hillside. Sweat begins to soak my loose cotton shirt before I reach the curving summit of the ridge and catch sight of the tomb. Ciri's tomb. I stop. The wind chills me, although the sunlight is warm enough as it glints off the flawless white stone of the silent mausoleum. The grass is high near the sealed entrance to the crypt. Rows of faded festival pennants on ebony staffs line the narrow gravel path. Hesitating, I circle the tomb and approach the steep cliff edge a few meters beyond. The willow grass is bent and trampled here, where irreverent picnickers have laid their blankets. There are several fire rings formed from the perfectly round, perfectly white stones purloined from the border of the gravel path. I cannot stop a smile. I know the view from here. The great curve of the outer harbor with its natural seawall, the low, white buildings of First Sight, and the colorful hulls and masts of the catamarans bobbing at anchorage. Near the pebble beach, beyond Common Hall, a young woman in a white skirt moves toward the water. For a second, I think that it is Ciri, and my heart pounds. I half prepare to throw up my arms in response to her wave, but she does not wave. I watch in silence as the distant figure turns away and is lost in the shadows of the old boat building. Above me, far out from the cliff, a wide-winged Thomas Hawk circles above the lagoon on rising thermals and scans the shifting blue kelp beds with its infrared vision, seeking out harp seals or torpids. Nature is stupid, I think, and sit on the soft grass. Nature sets the stage all wrong for such a day. And then it is insensitive enough to throw in a bird, searching for prey which have long since fled the polluted waters near the growing city. I remember another Thomas Hawk on that first night when Ciri and I came to this hilltop. I remember the moonlight on its wings, and the strange, haunting cry which echoed off the cliff and seemed to pierce the dark air above the gas lights of the village below. Ciri was 16. No, not quite 16. And the moonlight that touched the hawk's wings above us also painted her bare skin with milky light and cast shadows beneath the soft circles of her breasts. We looked up guiltily when the bird's cry cut the night, and Ciri said, "It was the nightingale and not the lark that pierced the fearful hollow of thine ear." "Huh?" I said. Ciri was almost 16. I was 19. But Ciri knew the slow pace of books and the cadences of theater under the stars. I knew only the stars. "Relax, young shipman," she whispered, and pulled me down beside her then. "It's only an old Tom's hawk hunting. Stupid bird. Come back, shipman. Come back, Marin." The Los Angeles had chosen that moment to rise above the horizon and to float like a windborne ember west across the strange constellations of Maui Covenant, Ceres World. I lay next to her and described the workings of the great Hawking Drive spin ship which was catching the high sunlight against the drop of night above us. And all the while, my hand was sliding lower along her smooth side. Her skin seemed all velvet and electricity, and her breath came more quickly against my shoulder. I lowered my face to the hollow of her neck, to the sweat and perfume essence of her tousled hair. "Ciri," I say, and this time her name is not unbidden. Below me, below the crest of the hill and the shadow of the white tomb, the crowd stands and shuffles. They are impatient with me. They want me to unseal the tomb, to enter, and to have my private moment in the cool, silent emptiness that has replaced the warm presence that was Ciri. They want me to say my farewell so they can get on with their rites and rituals, open the Farcaster doors, and join the waiting world web of the hegemony. To hell with that, and to hell with them. I pull up a tendril of the thickly woven willow grass, chew on the sweet stem, and watch the horizon for the first sign of the migrating islands. The shadows are still long in the morning light. The day is young. I will sit here for a while and remember. I will remember Ciri. Ciri was a... what? A bird, I think, the first time I saw her. She was wearing some sort of mask with bright feathers. When she removed it to join in the Race Me quadrille, the torchlight caught the deep auburn tints of her hair. She was flushed, cheeks aflame, and even from across the crowded common I could see the startling green of her eyes, contrasting with the summer heat of her face and hair. It was festival night, of course. The torches danced and sparked to the stiff breeze coming in off the harbor, and the sound of the flutists on the breakwall playing for the passing isles was almost drowned out by surf sounds and the crack of pennants snapping in the wind. Ciri was almost 16, and her beauty burned more brightly than any of the torches set round the throng-filled square. I pushed through the dancing crowd and went to her. It was 5 years ago for me. It was more than 65 years ago for us. It seems only yesterday. This is not going well. Where to start?
What say we go find little Nookie, kid?
Mike Osho was speaking. Short, squat, his pudgy face a clever caricature of a Buddha. Mike was a god to me then. We were all gods. Long-lived, if not immortal. Well-paid, if not quite divine. The hegemony had chosen us to help crew one of its precious quantum leap spin ships, so how could we be less than gods? It was just that Mike, brilliant, mercurial, irreverent Mike, was a little older and a little higher in the shipboard pantheon than young Marin Aspic. Ha! Zero probability of that, I said. We were scrubbing up after a 12-hour shift with the Farcaster construction crew. Shuttling the workers around their chosen singularity point, some 163,000 kilometers out from Maui Covenant, was a lot less glamorous for us than the 4-month leap from hegemony space. During the C-plus portion of the trip, we had been master specialists, 49 starship experts shepherding some 200 nervous passengers. Now the passengers had their hard suits on, and we shipmen had been reduced to serving as glorified truck drivers. As the construction crew wrestled the bulky singularity containment sphere into place. Zero probability, I repeated, unless the groundlings have added a whorehouse to that quarantine island they leased us.
Nope, they haven't, grinned Mike.
He and I had our 3 days of planetary R&R coming up, but we knew from Shipmaster Singh's briefings and the moans of our shipmates that the only ground time we had to look forward to would be spent on a 7-by-4-kilometer island administered by the hegemony. It wasn't even one of the Motal Isles we had heard about, just another volcanic peak near the equator. Once there, we could count on real gravity underfoot,
unfiltered air to breathe, and the chance to taste unsynthesized food. But we could also count on the fact that the only intercourse we would have with the Maui Covenant colonists would be through buying local artifacts at the duty-free store. Even those were sold by hegemony trade specialists. Many of our shipmates had chosen to spend their R&R on the Los Angeles. So how do we find a little nookie, Mike? The colonies are off limits until the Farcaster's working. That's about 60 years away, local time. Or are you talking about Meg in Spin Comp? Stick with me, kid, said Mike. Where there's a will, there's a way. I stuck with Mike. There were only 5 of us in the dropship. It was always a thrill to me to fall out of high orbit into the atmosphere of a real world, especially a world that looked as much like old Earth as Maui Covenant did. I stared at the blue and white limb of the planet until the seas were down and we were in atmosphere, approaching the Twilight Terminator in a gentle glide at 3 times the speed of our own sound. We were gods then. But even gods must descend from their high thrones upon occasion. Ciri's body never ceased to amaze me. That time on the archipelago. 3 weeks in that huge, swaying treehouse under the billowing tree sails, with the dolphin herders keeping pace like outriders, tropical sunsets filling the evening with wonder, the canopy of stars at night, and our own wake marked by 1,000 phosphorescent swirls that mirrored the constellations above. And still, it is Ciri's body I remember. For some reason, shyness, the years of separation, she wore 2 strips of swimsuit for the first few days of our archipelago stay, and the soft white of her breasts and lower belly had not darkened to match the rest of her tan before I had to leave again. I remember her that first time. Triangles in the moonlight as we lay in the soft grass above First Sight Harbor, her silk pants catching on a weave of willow grass. There was a child's modesty then, the slight hesitation of something given prematurely, but also pride, the same pride that later allowed her to face down the angry mob of separatists on the steps of the hegemony consulate in South Turn and send them to their homes in shame. I remember my 5th planetfall, our 4th reunion. It was one of the few times I ever saw her cry. She was almost regal in her fame and wisdom by then. She had been elected 4 times to the All-Thing, and the Hegemony Council turned to her for advice and guidance. She wore her independence like a royal cloak, and her fierce pride had never burned more brightly. But when we were alone, in the stone villa south of Feveron, it was she who turned away. I was nervous, frightened by this powerful stranger, but it was Ciri. Ciri of the straight back and proud eyes, who turned her face to the wall, and said through tears, "Go away. Go away, Meryn. I don't want you to see me. I'm a crone, all slack and sagging. Go away." I confess that I was rough with her then. I pinned her wrists with my left hand, using a strength which surprised even me, and tore her silken robe down the front in one move. I kissed her shoulders, her neck, the faded shadows of stretch marks on her taut belly, and the scar on her upper leg from the skimmer crash some 40 of her years earlier. I kissed her graying hair and the lines etched in her once smooth cheeks. I kissed her tears. "Jesus, Mike, this can't be legal," I'd said when my friend unrolled the hawking mat from his backpack. We were on Island 241, as the hegemony traders had so romantically named the desolate volcanic blemish which they had chosen for our R&R site. Island 241 was less than 50 kilometers from the oldest of the colonial settlements, but it might as well have been 50 light-years away. No native ships were to put in at the island while Los Angeles crewmen or Farcaster workmen were present. The